From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 27th day of March, 2019. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzlo at Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. He and Jackie Vakes, who we normally talk to on Wednesday, are swapping places this week because Mike's going to join us on a live edition of Commodity Week Friday afternoon after the USDA reports. Both the grain stocks and the acreage figures are due out at 11 a.m. Central Time. Now, for the rest of the day today, we'll talk a little bit about the agricultural news for the afternoon and take a deeper dive into what's been happening with the floods in the Western Corn Belt. Drew Lerner will be here from World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City, and we'll see what's happening in Washington, D.C. in the way of disaster relief for those farmers. And it all happens right here on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
We're now joined by Mike Zuzlo at Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Atchison, Kansas, to take a look at what happened in Chicago for the day. Hey, Mike, thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you, Todd.
Well, it's good to have you here. Let's start with why soybeans would have lost so much ground today.
Yeah, I think we started the week with some technical vulnerabilities, some sell signals in the oscillators that probably opened up the funds to the idea that we don't have, if you're a fund right now, we don't have a lot to fight the funds as far as fundamental information. You've got flooding, you've got situations that are promoting less corn acres, you've got a report or a couple reports still a couple days out. And so I think you started to build a fundamental case and a technical case at the beginning of this week. And then I think you saw this pile on almost from the currency markets. And it's kind of what we talked about last Friday with the deflationary mindset. And essentially the Fed has waved the flag of deflation as of their comments and their talk last week. At least that's how I think the market's taking it. So I think we saw that. And as a result of that, Todd, we made a new record low in the Argentine peso today. We made a new 2019 low in the Brazilian real. And so we're talking about a soy meal price at the U.S. Gulf that's about $30 more than the Argentine price at their Rosario port, and about $25 a ton more than what Brazil's port price is. So the stocks that compete against us continue to get cheaper thanks to the currencies. And so we had several factors that essentially just piled onto one another at this point.
So tell me a little bit about this, because sometimes you look at it and say, well, the dollar has strengthened against some of those currencies, but in this case, you're thinking that everybody's currency's just deflating.
Yeah, exactly. This is that currency war race to the bottom where everybody's worried about a massive slowdown. The United States has got the better looking lipstick on the pig, so to speak, as far as economic data. Our trade deficit narrowed by 15%. I think it was yesterday that was released. Yes, our consumer confidence numbers are slipping, but we have, I think, the best fundamentals right now and economic policies right now of anywhere in the world. I mean, we just saw across the wires here a few minutes ago that the British Prime Minister is willing to resign essentially immediately if the parliament over there passes the Brexit deal that she's asking them to pass. She's essentially saying, I'm out of here if you just do this one last thing for me. They're the fifth largest economy in the world. So these are kind of things that kind of sneak up on you. You see them coming, but then you also think, well, is it going to happen or is it not going to happen? And the bottom line is at this stage of the game for the trade is they see this deflationary market similar to 2015 and 2016, and they have no U.S.-China trade deal to back themselves up against. So yeah, that's kind of where we're at right now heading into the acreage and stocks report.
Yeah, so let's turn our attention to those reports very quickly. The acreage numbers are the one of most interest, and we'll get to the grain stocks too.
Yeah, the acreage numbers, I think if you game this out and you use USDA's February numbers, or earlier March numbers, I should say, of the supply-demand report, and then you use their agricultural outlook update for everything else. If you came in with 91 million corn acres, because USDA is putting us at a pretty high yield level, in fact, they're up there around the three-year high for the corn yield numbers, you're talking about a carryover of at 91 million acres of about 1.6 billion bushels, and maybe even a little bit underneath that. If you go in with 86 million acres of beans and use USDA's 49.5 yield, that's well below the three-year average. And even with that low of a yield at 86 million acres, you're talking about a 4.2 billion bushel production and about 880 million bushels of ending stock. So this helps explain, I think, why the bean corn ratio is hitting its lowest level for the new crop ratio since last November. The trade is starting to see not just what's happening with African swine fever, probably also more importantly, what may end up being a situation Friday when we get these numbers. And yes, there only is of March 1, but we'll also probably get a good idea of what type of financial situation producers are in terms of how they're going to rotate and whether they're going to rotate less into corn and keep more beans. And I think that's probably the biggest thing that I'll be looking at is what did the benchmark acreage number say here on March 1 based upon what producers' economic health is.
So what do you think the numbers will show exactly? Do you have a set?
Yeah, I keep a set. I'm at 91.6 on corn and 85.9 on beans and 46.8 on wheat. I just don't publish them in the news wires anymore because the algorithmic traders. I think that 91.6 is a very high number at this stage of the game because of the flooding. And this is, I think, where the trade will start to talk more about ending stocks figures, because not only will you get grain stocks, you'll know better about the feed and residual numbers for the corn and the export numbers for the beans, but you'll get these acreage numbers and then be able to assume that you're going to see a lot more prevent plant. And I got a text from a client yesterday asking if I'd seen Todd Hubbs's update. And so I think we're on the same page as far as the out here in this part of the country, prevent plant could be the highest in a decade.
Yeah, so there could be. Todd and I talked earlier in the week, and there could be an awful lot of prevent plant. I don't think that'll be surprised to many in the Western Corn Belt, especially as the snowpack is really slow to melt off, and it'll take some time, and that'll keep a whole lot of fields awfully wet in the Red River Valley, where, of course, the Red River flows to the north, not to the south, and so it gets colder as it flows up north, and those ice packs will just, they'll just hit actual ice and keep flooding and back things up to the Red River Valley. And then the snowpack in the Rocky Mountains is just enormous this year too. So
you and I are looking at maybe another couple 3 inches of snow on Saturday. I just put the snow thrower away and check the models this morning, and it looks like there's a Saturday Sunday system coming around just to put a little bit of a thorn in our side as well. So yeah, you've got that, and I think you've also got a situation now where the trade is going to have to start to figure out if the acres go below 90 million. That presents an opportunity for our carryover to go below 1.5 in corn. And will they continue to just say, oh, we got plenty of Argentine stocks, or will they try and put some premium in that December corn price?
Yeah, that was my next thought. So you're talking about a soybean carryout that doesn't change just because it's so large, it doesn't have that much of an impact, even if you lose 60 or 70 million bushels. But corn, if you go from 1.8 to 1.6, that's a pretty good size jump.
It is, and if you take it below 1.5, then you start to talk about rationing, and then it becomes the spread all over again. And that we talked at the beef house about that ratio, the new crop ratio. I can sincerely see that ratio getting down to about 2.1 or 2.15 under that type of scenario as we get into April, especially if the weather doesn't break in favor of getting field work and planting done. So then it goes back to the clients and subscribers and talking to them, okay, corn and wheat can probably hold the soybeans up. But I will be very blunt with you, and I've said this a couple, three times already over the last couple months. I just don't think we are prepared mentally for a billion bushel soybean carryover, and I'm sincerely worried about that from the fresh information I've been getting this week out of China and sources that have been talking to people in China about the African swine fever, and that my 20% loss in the hogs over there for a six-month window, a quarter or two-quarter window, may have to be pushed out to a higher number or keep it 20% for more than two quarters. And you're talking about crush margins in China right now, Todd, that are the worst since 2018 and doggone near the low ends and hitting negative numbers that we haven't seen since 2017. So that idea you and I've talked about them cutting the supply chain and just coming in and buying just pork and jumping out of the beans and meal for a while, I think that's becoming more of a reality. And that's probably why we heard that story about them buying 300,000 tons of pork potentially.
Yeah. So to be clear, you're talking about a billion bushel carryover for this marketing year. So by the end of the fall, USDA would have to change and up over a billion bushels because we're just not shipping.
Yeah, a 1920 carryover, I think, could approach that 995 million bushel carryover level. And I just don't think the trade is practically speaking and looking at my elasticity analysis, it's not even close to trading that right now.
Wait, so 1920, but what about 1819?
Well, I've still got a carryover level of just under 900 million bushels.
Oh, okay.
In 1819, with the idea that we're not going to slip too much more in this current marketing year because China is trying to play nice with us.
Okay. Hey, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That is Mike Zuzlow. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. In today's agricultural news, let's start with trade. The U.S. trade team is returning to China to continue negotiations. Ambassador Robert Lighthizer will lead that delegation. He dropped by Public Radio's Washington, D.C. studios Monday and jokingly told NPR that he's not a particularly optimistic person, but that he always says of the China trade deal, he is hoping, but not hopeful.
So, you know, we're working at it. If there's a great deal to be gotten, we'll get it. If not, we'll find another plan.
A couple of sticking points have been intellectual property rights and forced technology transfer. Lighthizer says progress has been made on these two fronts.
Yes, I think that on those issues and a variety of others, China is interested in having a deal. Now, the question will be the details and enforceability.
Well, the trade representative believes there are high-ranking government officials in China that recognize the value of operating on the open market and adhering to Western business practices. The efforts by the Trump administration that seek these trade policy changes are drawing some global support. Reuters reports the European Union shares many of the same frustrations over China's technology transfer policies and market access constraints and is, quote, a quiet supporter of the president's efforts with China. By the way, Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue has previously said China could double or even triple its purchases of U.S. agricultural products as part of the trade agreement. The current tariff climate between China and the United States slowed China's purchases of U.S. farm products, including soybeans and pork. Originally thought to be completed at the end of March, some experts now say a deal may be finalized early this summer. We'll stay with trade for the moment. Canada and Mexico this week are again pressing the Trump administration to remove steel and aluminum tariffs. The Canadian foreign minister met with the U.S. trade representative earlier this week and threatened to withhold ratification of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement if the duties remain in place. Ag Secretary Perdue and others have previously said that if the tariffs remain in place following the implementation of the USMCA, the tariffs would offset any gains reached in the agreement. Specifically, Canada is urging the administration to lift the tariffs without replacing them with a quota, telling reporters Canadians feel the right thing is there should be no 232 tariffs or retaliatory measures between our two countries, unquote. A trade official from Mexico echoed the comments, saying what industry in North America needs is the elimination of this tariff. Let's move a little closer to home now, where the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank reports farm stress and bankruptcies have increased in the upper Midwest, which includes dairy country. The Federal Reserve's 9th District reported 103 Chapter 12 bankruptcies in 2018. That compares to 79 in 2017. Farmers in the region continue to face low prices for commodities, including dairy products, and high production cost. Total costs for inputs like seed, fertilizer, pesticides, fuel, and electricity have risen by 50% since 2006 for Minnesota farmers. The District of the Federal Reserve includes parts of all of Minnesota, Montana, North and South Dakota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Dairy farmers in particular have seen hard times. Speaking of hard times, thousands of water wells are located within flooded areas of the Midwest that could be contaminated with E. coli, that according to the National Groundwater Association. The association says the number of wells impacted could be substantial because a large portion of the Midwest affected by flooding relies on groundwater for rural and small municipal water supply. Household, farm, and small business wells could be standing in water for several days, raising the potential for contamination. While the exact number of wells possibly affected by contaminated floodwater cannot be readily counted, Census Bureau data show over 1 million wells in 300 counties impacted by flooding. And finally, let's go back to Washington, D.C., where every Republican on the House Agriculture Committee signed a letter that will be sent to the House Appropriations Committee defending Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue's proposal to relocate the Economic Research Service, or ERS, and the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, otherwise known as NIFA, outside of Washington, D.C. A draft of the letter echoes some of Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue's main arguments in favor of the relocation plans, saying, "We believe relocating ERS and NIFA would build upon USDA's capacity to improve the agency's ability to recruit top talent from universities across the nation while being closer to rural America and reducing taxpayer expenditures." The letter asks Subcommittee Chairman Sanford Bishop, a Democrat of Georgia, and Ranking Member Jeff Fortenberry, a Nebraska Republican, not to include restrictions on the USDA plans in a future agriculture FDA spending bill. And that's a quick look at today's agricultural news. Don't forget, you can find and listen to all of our agricultural programming online at willag.org. That's just a website. You can play most of our radio programming right there on demand anytime you'd like, or it might be more convenient for you to use a podcast application on your iPhone or Android device. You can do that using iTunes, the Google Play Store, or now in Spotify. You might check out Stitcher or the SoundCloud app, or NPR One. However you listen to our programming, thank you so much for taking the time to spend with us.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
We know the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee says Congress will pass disaster aid for farmers and other flood victims, even if it's not in pending disaster legislation. Estimates of agricultural losses across the Midwest are in the hundreds of millions. Senate Finance Chair and Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley says he's working to ensure farm and ranch losses are covered in pending disaster legislation.
I've worked with the Appropriations Committee to expand eligibility so that Midwestern states like Iowa and Nebraska affected by the current floods will also be able to access those funds.
But for now, Mr. Grassley says there's no specific figure, with damage still being assessed.
But when we have that figure, whether this bill passes now or passes a few weeks from now, that money's going to be there, just like it's going to be there for California with the fires in California last year.
This could happen in a pending House bill, a Senate version still being written, a compromise between the two, or even a future disaster supplemental bill. Still, Mr. Grassley says, because farmers are helping each other now, that's the thing that counts most.
Iowa farmers who weren't impacted by the floods sending much-needed hay to livestock producers and ranchers elsewhere in Iowa and in Nebraska. Stories like these are glimmers of sunshine during the dark times of flooding.
The damage includes tens of thousands of acres underwater, millions of dollars of stored grain, lost roads, railroads, and buildings, and the sense now that only the federal government can save many producers from financial ruin. This is the closing market report for Wednesday afternoon. Drew Lerner, World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City, is now here. Drew, tell me about the flooding situation out west first, please.
Yeah, you know, the biggest worry that we have is that the wet weather pattern, even though it's taken a bit of a break here recently, is going to fire up again, and I'm pretty confident that that is going to take place. It should impact the lower and eastern parts of the Midwest initially as we go from mid-April into the early part of May. But the jet stream typically lifts to the north during that period of time, and so eventually we're going to push some of this precipitation farther north as well. As far as the damage so far, boy, it varies greatly, but a lot of folks are reporting, you know, bridges that are out and the damage to farmland close to the rivers is pretty substantial. It's always hard to say until we get the water out of the way to know exactly what kind of impact it will be. And the problem here is that we do expect this surplus moisture to be around for a while. Even if we can get the flood levels themselves to come down a bit, with the wet weather bias still in the forecast, it's going to be really hard for us to get out of the mess that we're in without a prolonged period of disruption to getting into some of these fields. So I think we still don't have a real good handle on how extensive it is and how bad it will be down the road. But I do believe very strongly that we're not done with the precipitation bias. And it's spring. You know, we always get some pretty good storm systems in the spring. And any year that we have saturated soil going into that typical wet period makes it really challenging to get into these fields. And the key is going to be temperatures, I think. We've got to get these temperatures up. And if we can get them up, when we have brief periods between storms, we might be able to dry out some of the well-drained fields and get into some of these fields for planting. But for right now, it doesn't look that great for the next few weeks.
What's the difference between that and, for instance, the places that have a lot of snowpack?
Yeah, that area that we're talking about here is mostly the Red River Basin. Now the eastern parts of the Dakotas and Minnesota, we have done a really good job diminishing some of the snow. And one of the comments that I'm hearing out of that region is that the snow has been melting and the depths are coming down, but they haven't seen a lot of real serious runoff quite yet in that area. And the reason for that is a lot of the most recent snow occurred when temperatures were bitterly cold, and the snow doesn't have a lot of water content in the top several inches. So the water or the snow has been receding, but there hasn't been a tremendous amount of runoff. Well, that's going to change because we're getting now into this much older snow that does have much higher water content. And so as we go forward through the next week to week and a half, a lot of that snow in the upper Midwest and northeastern plains will create a new flood area that will impact that Red River Basin of the north, and it will work its way farther to the north. We do expect to see that to be a slow process. The slope on that river basin is about 70 feet from the headwaters to the mouth of the Red River, and that's just a real problem when we get into situations like this. So as the snow melts, it's going to sit around for a while, and delays of significance will occur in farming activity across that region, unfortunately.
Hey, thanks, Drew.
All right, have a great day.
Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason.